Segundo here, and I must say that I'm impressed by the name of this week's guest. Heidi Julevitz, it sounds like a divine cocktail, a tall drink of water, or, if the bartender's sympathetic, a fair hair from the dog that bit me. I believe in Heidi Julevitz entirely because of her exotic-sounding name. I've yet to read this Believer magazine she's involved with, but I think that if a woman named Heidi asked me upstairs something that hasn't happened in 5 years, well, then I wouldn't exactly say no. Not even if she resembled Shirley Temple Black in her ambassador days.
So I am here with Heidi Julevitz, editor of the Believer magazine, as well as the new novel, not editing, but actually authoring it, The Uses of Enchantment. Heidi, how are you doing?
Very fine, thank you.
Very fine.
I'll be better after my coffee.
We're waiting for a cup of coffee
right now. It'll come soon. I keep looking longingly down the hall.
What I will do then is I will ask you an extraordinarily simple question.
Excellent.
And then the more intricate questions will follow as soon as you get the coffee.
Wait, but exactly.
First of all, let's talk about the let's give you a boilerplate question. What was the starting...
What's the title of your book?
What's the title of your book? I'm pretty sure it was The Uses of Enchantment.
My coffee.
All
right. Okay. It is called The Uses of Enchantment.
It is.
Okay, yes.
Is there an anagram?
What's my middle name?
Yeah, what is your middle name?
It's Suzanne. Thank you very much. I actually don't need anything. I'm fine just with this. Great, thank you. It's Suzanne.
That's an exclusive, I think.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever told anybody that before.
Fantastic.
Anyways, that's what happens when you get someone before their coffee.
That's absolutely. It's drink spells truth or whatever. But what was the starting point for this book? Was it Bruno Bettelheim, or was it Freud's Dora, or was it the painting? Where did the whole sort of psychotherapeutic muse strike from?
The psychotherapeutic muse has unfortunately been striking and striking and striking with me, and I'm sort of hoping now that it has struck itself out, because I do feel like that, you know, the whole sort of intersection of kind of confession and storytelling and therapy being kind of our mode of our modern mode of oral storytelling, you know, in which we, of course, feature as the protagonist. That was something I definitely was swimming around in my second book, and at that time was definitely reading a lot of Adam Phillips and, you know, other sort of psychoanalytic writers, and thinking very much about this intersection. And so with this book, I hope that I have finally exhausted that vein of inquiry.
Why are you so obsessed with psychotherapy?
Yeah, I don't know why. It's funny because I have been doing some research for my next book, and I'm on kind of a reincarnation kick, and I've been reading all about reincarnation, and of course, like, it seems like everything I'm interested in sort of starts to bring you back to this notion of just basically about how you create story, your identity is made up of these stories that you've sort of decided to tell about yourself, or that you've decided comprise who you are. And reincarnation is just another instance of that, where there are all these stories that you have inside of you that you have to discover, you know?
I wanted to ask you, I was reading this book, and it kind of reminded me of another nonfiction book. Have you read Michelle Stacy's The Fasting Girl?
No.
Well, anyway, it's this...
I should read it. The Fasting Girl?
No, The Fasting Girl.
The Fasting Girl.
It's about Molly Fancher. I'm not sure if you're familiar
with her. No, I'm not familiar with Molly Fancher.
Because there's a Victorian feel to this book, but it sort of... This is kind of ties into a very rather large, enormous question, which I'm going to have to answer.
Yes, a caffeinated question.
A caffeinated question. Basically, it's this book that describes Molly Fancher, who basically was this, as a young girl...
F-A-N-C-H-E-R?
F-A-N-C-H-E-R.
Okay.
As opposed to Fincher, no.
Yeah, I know.
But she
Fancher.
Basically... Fancher. But she basically got hit by a Brooklyn carriage. And because of this, she was holed up for the next 50 years of her life inside this apartment. She claimed to not eat a single thing in 12 years. She claimed to have clairvoyant powers.
Wow.
And Michelle Stacy wrote this interesting book that sort of showed the kind of cultural kind of reaction to this.
Which was
all these scientists came in and were trying to dispute her claims.
Uh-huh.
And this ties into your book, because this book, to me, I wanted to ask you if, like Molly Fancher, your book deals with this notion of kind of cultural sort of response to extraordinary claims along these lines, particularly as they relate to young girls.
Well, I mean, I guess in this instance, it's almost the inversion of that, where it's actually the culture that's making the extraordinary claims, and my protagonist is just sort of filling in. Mm-hmm. You know, essentially what the book ends up dealing with a lot is the recovered memory movement, or the sort of explosion of recovered memories. And this sort of happens really just around the time when Freud is being most challenged by feminist psychoanalysts and analysts like Alice Miller, and Jeffrey Masson, these people who are kind of leading this movement to say that, you know, Freud had sort of invented this this theory that overlooked a lot of his initial findings, i.e. the seduction theory. You know, that in fact these were not fantasies that people were having, that that they had been abducted, I mean, I'm sorry, that they had been abused or in some way sexually molested. That in fact these were real stories of molestation that were being kind of fuzzed over by Freud's theories. And so, you know, my character in a way is kind of exploiting this sort of hole that's been made, or this liberty that's been given to her as a patient, you know. And I think that that is something that happened very much after the recovered memory sort of realization came on the scene, and suddenly there were all these people who were remembering things. I mean, I had friends who were suddenly remembering things, and they were very much prompted by their therapists to remember these things. So, in fact, it was kind of the inversion of the Felcher situation, in that...
you're coming dangerously close to another term there.
I know, exactly. But that this character of mine doesn't initiate the situation... I mean, she does initiate her situation, but she's very much responding to a kind of cultural possibility. The culture has made it possible for her to do this.
Well, this brings up, actually, there was a very interesting review of this book at Salon by Marissa Meltzer. Meltzer, yeah, we'll keep with this sort of ridiculous, we'll speak as pretentious as we want to. But she observed that this book kind of had a rather sort of conservative viewpoint. Meaning that basically she was suggesting that adolescent girls, not only do they hold all the power of this kind of act of, you know, creating this victimhood, but they're also the very victim. And I wanted to know that, or actually I wanted to ask you about this, because given that you have one of the three sort of perspectives is what might have happened, how can we sort of find some sort of, I guess, truth within the sort of three narratives? I mean, it's sort of distressing when you're dealing with things like Freud, like psychology, like crime.
Well, I mean, it's interesting to me. There are a couple of reads that I think I got two reads from people who saw it as conservative, which I was interesting to me. It definitely was not at all my intention to come across as conservative, as it, well, it is some people's intention. It was not mine. You know, I more saw it as being a book about a very certain time period. I mean, it's a very much a book that's set in the 80s, in New England, in a place where there is this sort of history of witches and all these other sort of cultural messages that are saying to you, if you act out in this way, we will hang you either literally or figuratively. You will be socially hung out to dry, you know? And so, you know, I feel like my character was very much reacting to all of these very tightly sort of circumscribed rules, really, sort of, or social mores, you know, and historical mores. I think I'm answering two questions here. So that's sort of one answer. And then the other question, the sort of what might have happened, the what might have happened chapters end up being what happened, you know?
Oh, but how can we be sure of that?
Well, you know, I guess you can sort of, I mean, that's where you can sort of debate with yourself and with other people, I suppose. You know, I sort of look at them as being kind of, like if you look at the scenes of her as an adult, there's enough to kind of support the what might have happened chapters as what happened.
But see, this also assumes, however, that we are to actually buy these possibilities. I view what might have happened as like well, these people could be lying through their teeth. The author here could be totally lying through her teeth.
Yeah.
The only, I guess, narrative of the three you can truly trust is the omniscient narration of the present, or the, not the present day, but the 1999 section.
Right. And I guess that's what I'm saying is that in that section, you know, that sort of trustworthy section, there's enough that you realize, oh, okay, this is, in fact, what happened to her. And I saw the naming of the What Might Have Happened chapter as like the conditional aspect of those chapters, that it shifts as the novel goes on. So at first you're looking at it as, oh, this is possibly what happened during this time period. This is just one possibility. But then as it goes on, you realize, or sort of as I intended, one possible interpretation of it is that this is what happened to her, but it's impossible for her because she has so much discomfort, I guess, around that event, that it's easier for her to think about it as like she's the girl, she doesn't have a name, he's the man, he doesn't have a name. In this way, she's sort of she's disassociated, I guess, from this thing that has happened to her, and so she's turned it into this kind of almost fable-like story.
Certainly, but I mean, without giving anything away, the what might have happened sort of thing meant to me anyway that I could interpret whether she was actually victimized or not.
Well, that's absolutely the case. And I mean, and that is the case in every single section where the victim and victimizer roles are constantly shifting, you know? Yeah. So at first you're like, oh, the man is the victimizer and she's the victim. Oh, wait, no. He's the victim, she's the victimizer. And the same thing with the doctor-patient chapters, where it's the upper hand keeps shifting between the two of them.
I wanted to ask you, going back to this Freud issue and how, you know, of course, Freud's Dora in particular is a particularly, you know, in many ways despicable sort of portrait of...
It really is. I mean, have you read it recently?
I haven't read it in years, but I remember when I read it, it was just really quite extraordinary.
If you found it extraordinary when you read it years ago, then now you would find it even more so. I mean, I had read it, obviously, years and years ago, and had even read it not even so many years ago, and then read it when I was doing this book, and was really surprised. I was really surprised at how truly fictional this world feels, and that it would have passed for so long as a case study.
But simultaneously, this brings up what I was going to ask you in relation to Freud's Dora. Many of the men, in fact, all the men in this book are pretty much pushovers. I mean, there are several points where the man, if we can at least trust the veracity of this narrative, can escape this situation, and he decides not to.
Yeah.
Same thing with this, with the doctor.
Right.
You know, and I'm wondering why you made this decision. In a way, you're almost kind of using the same sort of nastiness that Freud did with Dora, you know?
Oh, you think? I mean, I guess I saw it as, I mean, I wanted to write an inverted, like, victim tale, you know? And, I mean, in the same way, it's like there are tons of times when, like, women could escape. Right?
Of course.
There's like there are always the, you know, it's like the woman this summer, the Austrian woman who finally escaped her captor, you know, and everyone's always like, or people who have Stockholm syndrome. It's always like, well, why didn't you leave? No one can understand why they leave. And when it's a woman, you don't say, oh, it's because she's despicable and she's a pushover. It's because she was actually psychologically sucked into this dynamic. And she was, and the guy is just, he's not a pushover. He's just, he's fascinated by this thing. He can't, of course he could leave, you know, but he's fascinated by her and he's fascinated by what she could tell him about himself. And so it's, you know, they both seem to have something to offer each other. And so he stays.
I guess, though, but going to this whole notion of like who is the victim and who is the victimizer and the roles constantly shifting, it seems to me that, I don't know, both seem to be, both have ways of escaping. Most of the scenes in this book involve two people.
Right.
Colloquies, to some degree. I actually wanted to ask you about that. I mean, what do you need, sort of like two-person scenes, or at least for this book, did you need to have? Because like a lot of this is taking place in like a therapeutic environment.
Yeah. You know, no, I saw those two, sections in particular that are involving just two people, that it, like they were very much supposed to be these kind of shadow movements for each other in a way, you know?
But most of the book, though, I mean, with the exception of sort of the winter escapades, takes place indoors, and I'm just wondering why you settled upon this kind of hermetic environment if you were inverting the whole notion of what therapy is.
Oh, I don't think I was inverting the notion of what therapy was. I mean, I said I was inverting what... No, I mean, and actually, I thought about that a lot, how I thought, okay, so this could be really static, you know? if you have two people in a therapy office. I mean, what it sounds horribly static, and it sounds like, I don't know, it sounds like those movies you see that were that had been a play and then they get made into a movie.
That's exactly what I was reading the dialogue, and I was thinking to myself, wow, there's like no actual sort of description, particularly during the notes sections. And I was thinking,
yeah.
I'm wondering why she went for this. Maybe something you can answer. Why the novel form for this as opposed to something like a play, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, and those specific sections are very much, they're very dialogue based. Yeah. And in a way that's in terms of my own sort of, you know, the challenges I throw up for myself. I have written, you know, my first book is like 90% landscape, you know what I mean? And I feel like, okay, I can do landscape, and I actually do landscape as a way to avoid doing interpersonal dynamics. And so in a way, this for me was a tying a hand behind my back kind of maneuver. It's like, okay, there is no landscape. You're in this very plain setting, and now you just gotta let these people go at it, you know? But I think a lot of books take place inside. I mean, I don't know. Like, there's a ton, I mean, you know, many suburban novels take place in a house, and I don't know, you know? I mean, when I started to think about it, and I was like, well, is this going to seem, like, how am I going to pull this off, two people talking in a room? But it's like, well, most novels are some people talking in a room, you know? I mean, the room changes, but, you know, it's frequently, and I think that's why it's important that the novel be made up of these three different sections. So that's where the movement comes in, is that you're moving narratively between these strands, so it never has a chance to feel too, like, or, you know, it's just claustrophobic enough, you know? And then you get a reprieve. Gotcha. You get to go to, like, a different time zone.
I'll pick up on this notion soon, but I wanted to first of all actually establish how you developed the kind of three perspectives. When did this kind of come about?
Well, I was definitely very inspired by Tim O'Brien's In the Lake of the Woods.
Okay.
Have you read that book?
Yes. I love
that book. Anyways, I am very much modeling this on that book. First of all, in that sort of like three, you know, and the, you know, he had three sections also. And then, and I loved the interplay of those. And I also loved the way that, the movement of the book was you were turning the pages because you wanted to find out what happened, you know? And so I wanted to create that kind of inexorable plot pull. But what I love about his book is that you're turning the pages to find out what happened, and suddenly you realize, like, you're not going to find out what happened. Or you're going to have to decide for yourself that this book is just going to lay out all the possibilities for you, and then it's going to be up to you to sort of, like, make something of it at the end.
But
you know?
This requires a great leap of faith on the part of the reader in terms of, like, okay, I'm going along for the ride, and yet where's the payoff, you know?
Well, I mean, I think the payoff is that you find out. I mean, basically, it's like you have all the information you need. It's like, I've given you all the information. I've told you everything that happened, you know? And then you kind of get to decide, okay, so whose side do you fall on, you know? I mean, and I, you know, like, do you think that she was the victim and he was the victimizer, or is it just really not that simple? Like, are they both? Is everybody both, you know? And I mean, you know, I mean, it's a really interesting thing. I mean, I guess what is payoff to people? I mean, I guess there are those two people I sort of use as like judges of what kind of a payoff you're looking for as a person who's encountering a book or a movie. You know, for me, I want, my payoff is like, I don't want the answer, you know? And when you give it to me, I get pissed off. You know, I feel like, ugh, you know?
Well,
you,
not necessarily.
You bailed. I don't know. I mean, I very much felt that way. I remember reading The Hours, and I was just like, this is gorgeous. It was three different strands, and they were, you could kind of maybe, like, impose your own relationship between them. And then at the end, it was like, oh, no, he's the son of the mother who killed, you know? And then I was just like, oh, don't do that, you know? That seems so cheap. I don't know. Like, to me, that kind of tying up of the ends feels very cheap. You know, I prefer, like, my idea of a perfect ending would be the ending of Safe by Todd Haynes, that movie Safe. Did you see that movie?
Yes.
Okay, that's my idea of a perfect movie, where you're just like, she's saved. No. She's worse than she was before. No, she's saved. No, she's not saved, you know? And it can go either way. And then also, depending on when you see the movie you're going to have and who you are at the time and what you've been through in the interim, you'll have a different interpretation, you know?
I guess, though, what I'm suggesting is, okay, well, to give you another, the last movie I saw that had the most perfect ending ever is Before Sunset. Because...
I didn't see that.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Okay.
You have an ending, and basically... you have a character basically say a line, and there's this implication, and we don't know what's going to actually happen beyond that, but yet there's also a sense of finality. And so what I'm wondering is in this case of the book, there is no real that kind of sense of finality with possible what carries on in the future. Like the end of Independence Day, Richard Ford's novel.
Yeah.
Or the end of Rupert Thompson's The Book of Revelations. These are books that come to mind that to me are like perfect endings in the sense that they have like, okay, this is supposedly the final thing, but no, it's not really. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I tried to end it. I mean, to be honest, the ending that I, or the ending kind of movement that I stole for this book was from The God of Small Things, where, and I thought that the way that book ended was so phenomenal, which is, and it's the way I tried to end this book, which is you end it, you don't end it at the end. Like, you already know what the end is. The whole book has been about the fallout, basically, you know? Like, the book has been about the terrible fallout from a moment, but you see the final moment of the book is actually this moment of innocence before any of the fallout happens. And there's something so, to me, heart-wrenching about that, where it's just like, oh, you know, and you see, like, you see Dr. Hammer at the end thinking, like, he's never going to see this girl again. It's never, he's never going to have anything to do with her again. And while you, as the reader, know, no, she's about to ruin your whole entire life, you know?
I guess, though, I guess I'm bringing up this up because, like, if we look at, like, your other novels, you know, there's more ambiguity in those. And in this, there's ambiguity. It's not so much, but there's a more sort of, I guess, you set up sort of elements of this sort of puzzle that you have to actually put together.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if there's either, if you need to have ambiguity to keep a narrative going, or if closure just isn't a factor for you, or if it's something where, how should I phrase this? Well, those other two questions I just kind of
I think you can have closure and ambiguity, you know? I mean, I think you can have closure on, like, just a sort of, like, what happened kind of level, you know? And I think that that's sort of what, you know, what genre novels operate on, the just, like, you know, what happened? Oh, here's what happened. And then that's it, right? And then you don't really have any more curiosity about it. It was all about information, right? And so I think you can have closure on an information level while not having closure on either an emotional or an intellectual level.
Sure.
That you can have a pleasant ambiguity in those two places, you know, so that you don't feel like you're thinking, well, I don't really understand what happened. You know, it's like, no, you know what happened, but does that actually then resolve all your emotional and intellectual issues as well? If it's that kind of book that's like tweaked you in that way, like. Ideally for me, no, it shouldn't resolve those for you, you know?
But at the same time, okay, well, I'll ask another question after this, but I mean, if you have a certain amount of resolution, enough resolution where you think, the minute you close a book, you say to yourself, okay, I think I know what happened. And then an hour later, you're thinking about this. No, that didn't actually happen at all. Even though there's a sense, there's a sort of trajectory for it. I mean, I guess... The difference I think we're having in terms of what our senses of literature is that you say, oh, well, you know, ambiguity all the way with just a touch of resolution, where I perhaps, the smidgen of resolution I would hope for personally in a book would be like a little bit greater. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
How much ambiguity is too much ambiguity, do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I do feel like as, I mean, it's interesting to me. I feel like I've run up against a lot of sort of, what I want to say, like cultural resistance to ambiguity. People really just seem to be very intolerant of it. And it is interesting to me because I find it so enjoyable, you know? And I mean, I maybe it's just a personal preference thing. I mean, maybe it is just like, you know, it's the same thing where now I feel like whenever you read book reviews, it's sort of like, it's like they hate books with style. That's the new thing. You know, this book has stopped, you know, it's like, what is that exactly?
You know? Yeah.
But, you know, again, it's sort of like this growing intolerance of style, you know? It's like, but isn't that how you write a book? I mean, what are you writing otherwise, you know?
And this goes into the whole issue of what is truly experimental and what is not, and or is experimental even a valid term? Is it more playful, you know? I guess, though, maybe I should ask you, for this book, what steps do you take to sort of justify an ambiguous sort of plot thread or an ambiguous kind of character action?
Right. You know? Well, again, I will say that I don't think that the plot is ambiguous. I mean, I could be wrong here. My intention was not to have an ambiguous plot. My intention was to have an ambiguous, like, for people's emotional attachments to the characters that you would not feel like this person is the person who I'm supposed to feel sympathy for. Because whenever you have a character like, oh, that's the character we're sympathetic toward, that means you're not sympathetic toward the other characters. And I wanted all of these characters to have their sort of moment where you were like, oh my God, you, I really feel badly for you in this moment. But then, like, in the next chapter, you realize, like, that you feel badly for the other person. And, you know, so that you're constantly having to shift your kind of, your sympathies, basically. Because I feel like it's so, that's too black and white for me. I feel like to say, like, oh, this is the person who's being wronged. And, I mean, again, I guess this is what, when I say I'm trying to invert the victim narrative, I'm not trying to make it the victimizer is now the victim. And et cetera. I'm more trying to just like continually shift that position. So it's just like whenever you sort of like it's a victim novel. Yeah. Well, it's actually usually a little more complicated than that, you know.
This is interesting to me because it seems that the variables in place constantly sort of shift.
Yes.
But like at the same time, you have the scene where Roz and Mary are having their little sort of repartee. I wanted to ask you two things actually.
Which scene? Which repartee scene?
This is, I believe, the first one, circa the 200 page mark, where basically, Mary is comparing her expression reaction to a viewmaster, which seemed to me a very interesting sort of way to describe emotion. I mean, it was also, personally, it threw me off. It was like this weird sort of cultural comparative metaphor that entered the equation, whereas I read another book and you'll at least see some sort of telling sign on the person's face that indicates that they move from exasperation to defensiveness or whatnot. And I'm wondering why you chose, for example, metaphors along those lines to describe the action while keeping, I mean, this is like one of the few sorts of like internal kind of introspective elements of that particular bit. And it's also built upon sort of, you know, basically these two characters are just like playing ping pong repartee to that.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, it's based off of what we were sort of establishing earlier about, you know, variables of these characters kind of shifting from victim to victimizer, whether this is kind of something that's kind of intended as possibly emotional detachment by throwing someone off with a viewmaster thing, or maybe you could describe this.
I don't. Who am I throwing? Who's thrown off? I don't get it.
I guess I was sort of. I'm sort of describing. I was kind of thrown off a little bit by the whole viewmaster metaphor, as you know, switching, because a viewmaster to me is like, you know, you go from, you see one slide, then you have blackness, then you have another slide.
Yeah.
And that just seemed to me a very curious kind of metaphor to use for the way that she perceived this, and this is the best of the three narratives that we can trust, you know?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it was just a metaphor choice. So if it doesn't, you know, maybe it's just, I don't know. I mean, I guess I was just seeing she was someone who could just very quickly shift from like one emotion to the next. It was more, you know, a way for her to criticize the doctor, I guess, or to show her as being someone who was a little bit, how should I say, that her emotions seemed kind of preset. For display, you know, and that they weren't necessarily indicating what she was actually thinking, you know, she had this facade. It was all a way to describe her sort of facade, that she had a facade in terms of how she presented herself.
But why the viewmaster over, say, like, you know, her eyebrow shifted upward or like some sort of sign, some physical sign that she detected that would indicate this kind of change, as opposed to sort of describing, oh no, it's from this variable to this variable. You know what I mean? You know, kind of.
Well, no, it's not a variable. She's just sort of saying that she has these. I mean, if you think about a viewmaster, it's just like, okay, here's this. Oh, here's this. Oh, here's this. And so she is essentially cycling through her She's a doctor, so she's cycling through her various faces, essentially, that she has for these emotions that are very much, you know, it's almost like an actor having these different faces when she's a doctor. So she has this kind of public face that she has to show to her patients.
I've been in therapeutic environments myself, and it's like you don't have like some sort of like abrupt kind of transition like that. You know, why was there no sort of gradual, I guess, gray area? This kind of goes into what the salon review that we were kind of discussing earlier, where she was sort of suggesting that that the gray area of like, you know, well, maybe, yes, there certainly is a kind of auctorial sort of sense of play in possibly inventing this whole notion of inventing this abduction and inventing this whole, you know, manipulation of both the man and the doctor.
Uh-huh.
And I guess, you know, if this is the truthful narrative, why not give us more of a realistic metaphor, a realistic
indicator, you know?
Well, I guess if you have read all my other books, even the ones that, I mean, that I guess this gets back to style. That's very much my style, you know? I mean, in another review, I was described as being idiosyncratic, you know, in the way that I speak about or the way I describe people. So that's very much the way I write. I don't really write about people's eyebrows, usually.
Well,
I don't know. I mean, it seemed to me like that is, it's very much a way that the world is both real and yet can be kind of seen in a more extreme and yet also telling light by comparing it to something. I mean, it's a metaphor, really. I mean, it's just a metaphor. It's not supposed to be, I mean, so I guess like in every book that you read, do you feel like the metaphor calls into question the truthfulness of the narrator? I mean.
Well, in this case, it's an unusual case because we have like the what might have happened versus the, you know, the notes, which are a subjective perspective,
yeah,
versus the possibly most truthful, omniscient sort of perspective of the 1999 section.
Right.
So when I'm reading and I'm going to the 1999 section thinking to myself, okay, well, here is possibly where I would start.
Yeah.
Here is where I would actually
start. But I can't use metaphors there?
Well, it's
I mean, it seems like a very strange rule suddenly. I mean, to feel like you can't trust somebody because they're using some slightly stylized language.
Well, it's not just a matter of just stylized. It's the way that the metaphor is sort of placed in conjunction with this thing where the Roz turns into sort of almost a kabuki theater kind of like, you know, like this.
Yeah.
As opposed to like, well, I don't know. In reading the dialogue, Roz struck me as a little bit more complex as to sort of go from a shifting, you know, you know what I mean?
Well, and in fact, Roz does become more complex. Yeah. That section that you are citing is one of the sections that's from Mary's perspective. And Mary is very invested in flattening Roz as much as possible because she dislikes her and she feels very threatened by her. And at the end, that's another one of those moments where you realize like, oh, actually, and Mary realizes it as well. Roz is actually not such a bad person, and she's kind of sold her. She's treated her very badly, and she's actually misread Roz very much. And so that scene that you are citing is one where she is very much misreading and hating Roz, you know, and determined to see her as this flat character that then later she turns out to be much more sympathetic and much more, you know, not at all as sort of evil as Mary and sort of kabuki, you know. I mean, Mary's kind of mocking her when she says that about her, you know?
Well, the other thing, I mean, this also goes back to the other question of, you know, how much of the sort of dialogue between therapist and subject is very much like repartee based.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering why repartee over sort of, the other thing that's interesting, too, is that we never really see much in the way of, like, these kind of great gushes of conversation out of Mary. It's just sort of bang, 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 bang. Why did you decide upon that approach as opposed to sort of, you know, I guess, you know, a lot, I mean, granted, taking into account that this is sort of questionable therapy to begin with.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I don't know what were you saying? What is the?
I guess why the characters didn't necessarily sort of gush in therapy, and it was more of a repartee situation as opposed to, you know, or at least you didn't give.
I see. Yeah. I see. I feel like she was very guarded in therapy, and not only that, she was actually playing a game. I mean, she was very overtly messing around with this doctor, you know, and so it was much less of a. She wasn't going there to be. What's the word? To be cathartic, you know what I mean? She was going there with a real ambition to mess around with this guy, you know? And so she sets him off on a couple of wrong tangents and then they're off, you know? And the same thing when the mother goes in and gets, she's being therapized, I mean, inadvertently, because she goes in pretending to be somebody else. You know, and she constantly just talks about how pointless it is to be in therapy, and she's already sort of thought circles around the whole notion of, like, knowing that you've done, you know, like, admitting that you are a certain way, and, like, what does that really do in terms of helping you in your life, and et cetera. So it's all these people who are very therapy resistant, and so I guess to have them go in and gush would be a very much more typical therapy situation, and none of these really fell under that category, you know?
But also the Dr. Hammer really does not, really isn't really very assertive in these therapeutic situations. I mean, he knows the history. She's come from somebody else.
Uh-huh.
He knows that, you know, there's this terrible sort of undercurrent that she has coming in.
Yeah.
And it would seem to me, I'm just wondering why you made the decision to make him sort of this more kind of passive, more like accepting of the role reversal that occurs and things like that.
Well, he's in a very, I mean, he's in a weak position, you know. He's this guy whose career has essentially almost been ruined,
yeah.
You know. And so he's a very tentative person at this point. He's kind of coming back from a pretty serious professional blow. And so he is trying to be much more kind of careful and tentative, you know, and so that's sort of his... That's just his background at the moment. That's his past, and that's affecting how he's behaving now.
I'm also curious about Mary's chapter.
Mm-hmm.
There's one chapter that it's just called Mary's chapter.
Oh, that's a typo.
I was wondering about that. I was wondering if that was a deliberate
move. I flipped through that, and yeah. I was like, oh, my God, I can't believe... Anyways, yeah.
Okay.
I don't think my fault either.
Speaking of typography, you chose a font where the numeral 1 was actually an I, and I was wondering why... Was that a deliberate...
I didn't choose that font.
You didn't choose that font?
No.
I was wondering if you were just trying to pronounce the
That would be pretty funny, though.
Yeah, I didn't know if that was a sort
that
of
That would be very
like,
funny. No, that wasn't my font choice, unfortunately, but yeah.
Okay. Well, going back to the notion of variables, you have things like grief tea and hyperradiance and things like that.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about this and also the fact that there's a lot of sort of like, there's the Rwanda organization.
Yes.
There's that joke about Pursue that's sort of like this wordplay that's slightly cornball. I was wondering if you could talk about these various elements of like having not just grief tea, but also like these sort of things to play around with. What is wordplay?
I don't know. You know, I feel like it just fits in because it is such a book that's so much about communication and how it can be misconstrued. You know, then there are all these, you know, like with the grief tea, it's like the aunt supposedly is this, she has a company, a sort of therapeutic tea company, and the sisters actually realize they don't even know if you would drink grief tea in order to feel grief or to not feel grief, you know? And so I guess it's just a way to sort of underscore the kind of... The murkiness, I guess, of words sometimes.
Are these intended as sort of clues that don't look at absolutes here? Don't look so literally minded at this book because there's a lot of ambiguity? Or
no, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's just sort of to. It's all part of, I guess, the kind of. I guess hyperactiveness. I guess a little bit of you know, you can either see it as something that's just what it is, or you can kind of you know, you could just sort of accept grief tea as grief tea, you know, or you could actually like turn it around in your head a little bit, you know. I mean, the only reason it comes up, I mean, literally, I'm writing it, and I had, you know, thought about grief tea. I was like, how funny it would be to have grief tea, and then I realized, like, well, if you had grief tea, like, I actually didn't know if you were to go to a store and buy grief tea. Whether it would be, you know, for feeling it or for not feeling it, you know? I always think it's so interesting, even when you're writing something, how you think you've stated something and it's very clearly stated, and then you realize that it actually has all these different facets to it that then you can kind of play around with, you know?
I want to talk about also the concept of hyperradiance. Mm-hmm. Was this based off of anything specific that you read, or?
No. I mean, I did use the, there was a book that I read that was about like colonialist Indian abductions, and how there was this historian, Mary Beth Norton, made a connection between those and then the witchcraft trials afterwards, and how it was this sort of Indian fear of Indian abduction, this kind of deep cultural terror, it kind of gave rise or opened up a space for the witch trials to happen, basically, and that kind of persecution and et cetera, and catharsis, really, you know? It's like fear catharsis. The hyperradiance thing was all Dr. Hammer, man. He made that whole thing up.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Hammer don't hurt him.
Exactly.
Actually, I wanted to ask you, I mean, there's some very, Dr. Hammer and Mary Veal are very unusual character names.
Yes.
So I was wondering why you chose very sort of blunt surnames for these characters.
Well, yeah, I mean, again, it's all just part of, you know, on a certain game playing, you know, on the word level for me, you know, and also sort of indicating that, you know, you are meant to take this seriously, but there's also, you know, that this is a real world, but you know, it's not going to be the real world that you recognize necessarily.
I figured since you were concentrating this in the '80s, you had "You Can't Touch This" playing in the back or something. I don't know. Or you were contemplating bankruptcy in Fremont. I don't know.
That would be very funny. Yes.
We got to wrap this up here. Okay. I do want to bring up one thing, which I'm sure you've been asked about every single interview, and that is, but I want to kind of talk about it in a different way, and that is the anti-snark manifesto, which has been...
Please record the eye roll.
Do you think... I want to actually bring this and touch it in with... Or tie it in, rather.
Yeah.
Touch it as well, I suppose. Yes. With the Believer. Do you think that the Believer has kind of lived up to this anti-snark manifesto that you wrote so many years ago? Or?
I do, yeah.
Is there any sort of grounds for, I suppose, shifting things? Or?
Well, I mean, we have shifted things. I mean, one of the things we've done, you know, our original conception of the magazine is that it would only be really long pieces, that it would only be long essays. And the whole notion is that it was going to sort of provide a slight antidote to the short reviews and the ever, you know, getting ever shorter reviews in other review venues. But then there seemed to be, there was that huge hullabaloo between the Times editors on Book Slut. And there seemed to be a sense that the Times was going to start reviewing less and less fiction and definitely less debut fiction. And then we sort of felt, well, if they're not doing it or these other places are going to not do it, then we probably should. And so then we initiated a a one page review section so that we have 6 one-page reviews every month.
I guess, though, like, for example, Nick Hornby's column.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a risk that he could be almost a more highbrow form of Harriet Klausner in the fact that he writes nothing but positivism.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't there something about, like, laying one's cards down on the table and offering, not necessarily, I mean, okay, to bring up the Dale Peck review.
Yeah.
I mean, I object more about the literalism behind this, the amazing sentence, Rick Mooney is the worst writer of his generation. That's an extraordinary sort of thing to say. But
also unprovable, though.
It, well,
you know, I mean, I guess I feel like the reason that, you know, I feel like there are writers who are extremely critical, and I mentioned them in my essay, and but Daniel Mendelsohn, I mean, that guy pulls no punches, but he only says things that are actually provable, thereby showing that he is a serious intellect. You know, he's not out there just to throw slanders around, you know, and call attention to himself, which is what, you know, Dale Peck, I didn't even want to read past that first sentence because I was like, okay, this is not going to be an intellectually serious takedown of Rick Moody. This is just going to be someone throwing their fists around,
but
you know?
But certainly, though, I mean, I will give Peck this. He certainly had passion and enthusiasm, a love for books, even in this really sort of highly viscerally charged slanderous, perhaps, takedown, you know.
But to me, that felt less like, you know, that felt less like a way to express his passion for books or even to very smartly offer a cultural corrective to a writer he didn't respect very much, and it felt like an attention-getting maneuver.
But Mendelsohn,
you know,
is okay in your book. Like, did you meet his friends in takedown?
Yeah, I thought that was incredible.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you think that's an acceptable form of criticism to you?
Yeah, because it's very intellectually... it's like every step is, it's totally, there's, like, there's a lot, it's a logic proof, you know what I mean? Like, the guy is airtight in the way he thinks. He doesn't just say, Jonathan Franzen's the worst writer of our generation.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like, Mendelsohn would never say something as sloppy as that, you know?
So if you were to have...
He would never say it. He would just, like, give some... He would give you the proof and that let you make that call, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So you're saying that if you have a sort of visceral criticism that is possibly a negative review and you have it supportable by examples and it's constructive, that's acceptable to you?
Absolutely. Okay. And that's what I say in my essay.
Okay.
Which
then,
somehow no one managed to actually read it, I don't think.
You know, I did read it. But I mean, I'm just trying to clarify here. I mean, I'm wondering, though, then why have someone like Nick Hornby just reveal positive things about a book? Because then I think, well, I don't know what he doesn't like, so I can't kind of get a sense of his tastes. You know what I mean? It's sort of like... there's some confusion here because, I don't know, I mean,
I personally feel that criticism should be really sort of constructive. I don't think it should be all positive or all negative. Yeah. You can do it the other way. I mean,
I totally agree with you. I mean, to be honest, I just don't think that that's really what Hornby's column is looking to do. You know what I mean? He is, again, he really is an enthusiast, and he is expressing his enthusiasm over books, you know? But I think there are other places in The Believer where there is that kind of more constructive criticism and, you know, in the longer essays.
You feel, though, the one-pagers are really sort of Mendelssohnian to some degree? Or?
No. I don't think you can be Mendelssohnian in one page. You know, I think it's impossible. You know, part of what's Mendelssohnian about Mendelssohn is that he writes these really intensive, like, thousands and thousands of words, you know, all of which are utterly gripping to me. You know, but that he needs space. You need space to be able to develop that kind of an argument, you know? And I mean, it is an issue that I have with our own one-pagers. I mean, we are doing them because we feel like those books need to get some attention, but it's the area that I'm most dissatisfied with in the magazine and that we are trying really hard to rethink. Yeah, because I just don't think, if the idea is to kind of call attention to a book, is using 650 words the way to do it? I kind of don't think so.
I agree with you.
You know, I feel really dissatisfied with those, and I feel like they're also extremely hard for people to write those things. That it's really, really, it's asking writers to do the impossible. It's asking them to do the thing that really no one can do well, which is, you know, write a book in this very short period of time and say something meaningful without just having to like describe the plot, which is really all you have space for, you know, in a page. So.
I'm wondering,
rethinking it. If you have any ideas, I'm happy to hear them.
I mean, I think, though, for example, like, because people look to The Believer, and they look at their literary coverage, at least the Lit Blogosphere and various other places, and Nick Hornby is kind of the kind of crowning sort of representative of The Believer, and he writes nothing but positive enthusiasm.
Yeah.
But now I'm hearing from you that, you know, oh, well, the Mendelssohn sort of, you know, tactic of which I agree with, too, where it's a very visceral, supportable kind of review, is just as valid. And I'm just wondering... Yeah. What we can do to sort of shake this impression that The Believer is all about Hornby. Maybe a collection of some of these one-page reviews instead of a collection of the Hornby?
Yeah, but the one-page reviews aren't really, you know, I mean, I don't really feel like they're very representative of The Believer. I feel like they're representative of what a one-page review can be, you know, which to me is a kind of, it's just... Ugh, I could talk for hours about that. Believe me, we've thrown around so many idea emails about how to shake that section up in particular, you know?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, even to the point of, I think that Hornby is a very, you know, we were so lucky to have him write a column for us. He has his own very, like, particular, hilarious way of talking about books. And, you know, he was a facet of the magazine that maybe was the most visible facet because he's the most famous person who writes for us, you know? But I don't think that he necessarily, you know, I mean, it's like in my original essay that I wrote, I mean, I'm praising James Wood and Daniel Mendelssohn, two people who are not known to be nice, you know? And I uphold them as, like, my models of what critics should be doing. So yeah, you know, I mean, it's an interesting question. I do think that the Believer is, you know, we have had Hornby, and we're not going to have him anymore. So we're looking for someone to fill his place. I think he's going to stop in a few months.
Really?
So who knows? Maybe we'll get Dale Peck.
That would be the ultimate. That would be the great way to really treat people. Well, I know you have to go.
That would be so hard.
I know you have to go. Heidi.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
There was a handshake that just happened.
Yes, there was a handshake.
There goes my child.